Thank you. Be seated.
Before we start, the court would like to acknowledge the presence of some of our distinguished guests in the audience. The Supreme Court of the state of Veracruz is visiting this week, and we have met with them some, and they are also having programs at the University of Texas and elsewhere. And we are very delighted to have them here on an exchange. Thank you so much. The final cause for the morning is an original mandamus proceeding, the Honorable Michael O'Connor, Justice versus the First Court of Appeal. The court is ready to hear oral argument from the relator.
May it please the court. Ms. Michael O'Connor will present argument for relator, and Mr. Steve Gibbons will present argument for the real party in interest. Ms. O'Connor will open and is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. My name is Michael O'Connor, and I appear today in my official capacity as Justice on the Court of Appeal. Justice, Chief Justice Oliver Parrott appears for the First Court of Appeal.
Is there a conflict of interest here?
Pardon?
Is there a conflict of some sort?
No, Your Honor. I think it's necessary for the court to be represented. And I think the orderly administration of justice would require that the Chief Justice appear before the court, even though, as in this case, Chief Justice
was on your side.
Was on this side, yes. But I think if you, anything else, I mean, we discussed this issue internally, and that's why Chief Justice Oliver Parrott signed the brief for the majority of the court, because she is the Chief Justice, and I think that was a correct decision. The immediate questions before this court, I suggest, are three. First, whether a court of appeal can decide that a justice on the court cannot file a dissent. Second, whether that decision interferes with this court's jurisdiction. And the second question I'm going to leave to Mr. Gibbon. Third, whether the court of appeals can decide that it is not going to issue consistent opinions.
Justice O'Connor, are you saying that there is no limitation on the authority of a justice on a court to write whenever he or she wishes to write?
I think the rule is, should be, and I don't think it's written anywhere, as much of the common law is not written down. It's our assumption. The assumption is that whenever a judge can vote on a matter, a judge can dissent on a matter. As this court has shown, when you have a dissent from this court on an administrative order appointing someone to the State Bar Board of Directors.
Well, surely when an issue is moot or when answering a question would be the rendition of an advisory opinion or when the court has no subject matter jurisdiction, there are limitations on the authority of the judge to speak or to write on that issue, are there not?
Well, if a court has no jurisdiction, I don't understand why it's taking a vote in the first place. But if a court can take a vote, a judge can dissent.
But your position is that even if the majority of the panel of the court says we have no jurisdiction to consider the case, that you can write an opinion saying I disagree.
Well, a court always has the authority to examine its jurisdiction. Yes, indeed. When a court says I don't have jurisdiction, another judge on the court may say, well, I think you're wrong because we do have jurisdiction. Yes, a court, all the cases say, this court has said repeatedly, a court inherently has the power to determine that it has jurisdiction.
But you were not on the panel that decided this case, were you, in the first instance?
No, I was not.
And Rule 79 says it's the Chief Justice of the Court of Appeals who designates the panel to decide the original submission, correct?
Yes.
And so this is not a case where you have dissented on motion for rehearing for the entire court to sit en banc to decide the case, is it not?
No, it was a motion en banc, but it wasn't a motion made on rehearing, if that's the question.
Why does Rule 79 not control the disposition of this case?
Well, I think it does control it. I don't understand how it would not control it.
You were not a member of the panel to decide the case, correct?
I did not attempt to dissent from the panel opinion. I never attempted to dissent from the panel opinion. I dissented from a motion that this court, and there was no, that the motion was put to a vote, a motion for en banc, there was a tabulation of votes, and I dissented from that vote. As I was saying, that the I believe that the three immediate questions, the ones I defined, I call those immediate because I don't think those are the critical questions in this court, before this court today. It's not whether on September 12, 1991, the Court of Appeals voted 5-4 not to permit filing of a dissent. That's really not the issue. If the vote had gone the other way, it still wouldn't be the issue. The issue is not whether on March 13, 1989, the court voted 8-1 in favor of inconsistent opinions. If the vote had gone the other way, that's still not the issue. I believe that the issue before this court today is whether the court had the authority, the power, to even take such a vote.
Justice O'Connor, is the relief you're seeking the right to file this dissent officially with the court, or is it to seek publication in the official reporter, which is the West system?
Well, I don't believe that West is our official reporter, but West is the person who does publish our reports. But I think one follows the other, Your Honor. I think once I have it filed, it in fact must be published.
How would this extend to the court's rule about publication of opinions and non-publication of opinions? Could any justice on your court procure the publication of an opinion by another panel if that panel desired that it be non-published?
Well, I don't think I have to address this issue with all due respect because
the
majority was published.
When you talk about constitutional rights, and when you invoke constitutional questions here, it's very hard for us not to think about similar situations, other situations, or where any rule we might set down would lead.
Certainly, but in this case, the panel opinion was published. You bring up an interesting question when you say whether or not West is the official reporter. You will find two instances, one in the Ninth Circuit, one in the Tenth Circuit, where a judge was not permitted to file a dissent. The judge took their opinion, certainly in the Ninth, I haven't looked up the Tenth Circuit case, sent it directly to West, bypassing the clerk. Because West is not the official reporter of the courts, that in the West published that dissent with, as an appendix, the majority opinion. But I'm here today only on the issue of whether the court can order the clerk, in this case, whether the court has the authority to decide whether or not a dissent can be published. And I say the court has no such authority. I likened it, the only analogy I can come up with that may make sense is that it's as if a board of directors of a corporation got together to vote not on changing the bylaws or starting the procedure for changing the articles of incorporation, but as if a board of directors got together to change the statute that creates corporations and say we're going to be a different kind of entity other than a corporation. I don't think board of directors of a corporation has the authority to go change its own grant of authority from the state. Well, the Court of Appeals is working under this system called the common law. Common law is made up largely of unstated assumptions. It was invoked this morning by Mr. Melvin Dow. But the common law is much like those of you who are familiar with computers, the operating system for the computer, the operating environment, what must be in the computer before you put in the program, because without that operating system, it's not going to work. Another operating system is the civil law system. Well, our operating system is the common law system. And the common law says that a judge may dissent from anything a judge gets to vote on. The common law system also says, unstated in most cases, that a court, the only function of a court is to issue consistent opinions.
Your position that the common law that you are arguing and rules provide a sufficient basis for mandamus to issue in this case without consideration of your constitutional arguments?
I think so. If the question is, as I think it is, what is a court under our common law system? If you go over to the federal system and say, what do you consider a court that sits in bank? What do you, in three panels? What is that institution? The federal system will say a court that sits in panels we answered that question in 1941 is what the federal system will tell us. the federal system would say when the United States Supreme Court answered the question in the textile mills case, we resoundingly said that a court that sits in panels is inherently one court. In that case, Congress, through the Judicial Act in creating the courts of appeals, the federal courts of appeals, only provided that they sit in panels. There became a dispute between the Ninth Circuit principally and the Third Circuit. The Ninth Circuit kept criticizing the Third Circuit for sitting en banc. And in an opinion that had otherwise nothing to do with in the textile mills opinion out of the Third Circuit said, and by the way, we can sit en banc when we want to. We're doing it today. The Supreme Court of the United States took that issue and wrote on it. It's technically very difficult to get these underlying assumptions from the court. So the Supreme Court took that unusual step and took that issue and said, even though Congress made no provision for sitting en banc, I believe my time's up and I'm going to have to give up, the court inherently has the power to sit en banc.
Is it your contention that if there was a rule of appellate procedure that prohibited the writing and filing of the dissents from a request to sit en banc, that would not be enforceable?
No, I think Article 1 of the statutes, which is now 5.001 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, says that the legislature adopted the common law as it existed in England at that time, when it's not inconsistent. When they amended it to make it into the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, they changed the wording a little bit. So I think that, yes, this court can change the common law. The legislature can change the common law.
So you think that would be an enforceable rule if this court deemed in the proper administration of justice in the state that a justice should not be able to file a dissent such as you seek to file in this case? That would be enforceable.
Well, then you do have to face a constitutional issue.
Well, I'm asking you, is it enforceable?
Before you reach the constitutional issues, I think this court does have the right to change the common law, and the legislature does too. Whether the U.S. Supreme Court would say that's an interference with your rights of First Amendment, I don't know. I really don't. I think I don't have to get that far. I think that this court the state would look very strange, in fact, for to silence the judges on the courts of appeals. The dissent serves an enormous benefit to this court. The dissent, in every case, whether it's right or wrong, it gives an impartial review of the case below by someone who has no financial interest in the case.
Just a comment. Your time's about to expire.
We'll extend the time for the co-counsel to make an argument.
Let me ask you a question. I'm assuming that the clerk of your court serves at the pleasure of the court.
Yes.
A majority of your court has instructed the clerk not to file your dissent.
Yes.
You are seeking us to mandamus the clerk to file your dissent, or are you seeking some other relief?
Well, I think that the mandamus is against the first court, that the first court has no such authority. This court's already said that.
So what specific relief are you requesting us from us?
They have no right to vote on whether or not a dissent may be filed. When a court when any motion is put to the court, a judge on that court, anyone who participates in the vote can dissent from the vote.
So are you really not asking us to order the majority of your court to withdraw their order to the clerk?
Yes, and take no such further votes on the inherent power of the court. The court doesn't have the power to decide that it's going to be an inconsistent court or that dissent can't be filed. We are an intermediate court, and we're extremely limited in what we can do, constitutional statutes, what you tell us, and what we've said before. So we don't have the power to change the nature of us as an institution.
If mandamus issues in this case, won't it result in the opposite result from which you desire, and that is consistency? Because won't the panels merely decline to circulate written opinions of the panel for civil reviews and input by other members of the court? Thus, you would not have occasion to vote on it.
Well, I think that would be, again, in bizarre. And it's because we are a full court. The Supreme Court in Textile Mill says to consider a full court anything less than a full court is to disenfranchise a judge on the court. I have a right. This court can sit in panels. What if you became started sitting in panels? Do you think that any panel of three could do what it wanted? I doubt it. You want the Court of Criminal Appeals has issued at least 10 dissents from en banc motions that fail, just like this case. There is no authority in the state of Texas to deny me the right to file the dissent from a motion en banc, period. There is no authority anywhere to deny me the right to file this dissent.
Is there any authority anywhere that specifically gives you the right to dissent in this type of a situation?
Well, I would...
There's no law to prohibit it, but there's no law giving you that power, the authority, or the right.
The common law we learn by experience. And Justice Gonzalez, you filed a dissent from the adoption of Rule 76A. First time in the history of the state of Texas that had been done. Now, if that didn't limit you, then you're filing this rather unusual dissent. Certainly, in this very traditional dissent, a dissent from en banc, certainly I have the authority to do that.
I'm asking you, is there any authority, specific authority, that gives you or me or anybody else on an appellate court the right to file a dissent in any case in this situation?
I think if you look at the rules for a court of appeals and they say the opinion of the court is in fact the opinion of the full court, I think that gives me the right to file a dissent.
The people who elected you give you that right?
Well, it's the Constitution, Your Honor. I mean, the Constitution tells the Court of Appeals, you're this kind of institution. People forget to do concurring and dissenting opinions. And here I am, I'm on the court, and I get to do a concurring or dissenting opinion from anything on which I vote.
Counsel, in reality, in the history of American law, so Chief Justice Marshall became Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. They rendered seratim opinions, did they not? They each wrote on every case.
Well, we would mow down more of the trees in West
Texas. It's as old as the common law, yes. I understand it would kill the forests, but we've come close to it already. But that's as ancient as the common law.
It goes back.
Every judge is there individually, whether by appointment, whether by election. They hold office individually. They sit as a whole court, and each of them has a separate voice. Isn't that correct?
Yes. But see, that's not just the common law. You trace that back, it goes to Paris, where so many of the people who taught in England came from, even though they were a civil system. It goes back to Bologna. The Romans, in fact, had three court systems, and everybody got to write. But in conclusion...
Well, the history on it is mixed, though.
Pardon?
After Marshall became Chief Justice, the court always spoke with one voice for about a five-year period. There were no dissents.
They
weren't filed for whatever reason.
I will give up my right to dissent when the judges on this court give up your right to dissent. I don't think y'all are willing to do it, and I'm not willing to do it either.
Counsel, the Chief Justice mentioned that the first 5 years of Marshall's tenure, there were no dissents, but the balance of the remaining 27 years, I believe, there were dissents of his term.
I'm taking more than my time, but there's one thing that I would really like to point out. If you read the Textile Mills case, you see how hard both courts, Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, had to work to get the issue before the Supreme Court. It was unusual the way they took on that issue. The issues of the common law are seldom written about. They're our operating system, and we seldom write about them. We have mowed down half of East Texas to talk about whether or not a person not named in an interrogatory gets to testify. Barely a twig has been sacrificed for the common law. I think this is a unique opportunity for this court to talk about what we're about. What is a court? Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Judge,
how much time did you originally allot for the co-counsel to make?
5 minutes.
You may have 5 minutes.
Thank you.
My name is Steve Gibbons. I'm here on behalf of the real party in interest, Richard Fott, from the law firm of Gibbons, Winkler & Harvey here in Austin. Realizing that my time is very short, perhaps I could pick up on a couple of the questions that were posed by First Justice Gonzalez, if I may. I believe your question was, is there any authority directly allowing this? I would say, in part, and in addition to what Justice O'Connor pointed out, Rule 90E of the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure, which says any justice may file an opinion concurring in or dissenting from the decision of the Court of Appeals. It would seem to me that the only question that you might ask is, was this a decision in this case? And I've cited in our third supplemental brief case law, one case being from the United States Supreme Court, which directly addresses that issue and in part states that that term is to be extremely broadly defined and would certainly encompass and include the disorder decision that we had here. In response to Justice Phillips' question, which, if I may say so, I think was perhaps one of the most interesting questions asked, that's just my own quarter, perhaps there were other questions that were more interesting. And that question was, I believe that question was whether or not when we have these situations where we allow publication and sometimes we don't, is that constitutional? I believe, if I may, I'd like to distinguish that instance. I believe there's another appellate rule which I can't sit here and cite right now, but it says if a lawyer or counsel is faced with that situation, he may make a subsequent motion and say, you guys publish it. And as we know, he can file a mandamus with this court, which it happened on the Court of Appeals, saying, publish my decision. In that case, you don't have a prior restraint on free speech, if you will, as we obviously do, I would argue, in this case.
If Justice O'Connor were prohibited by law from speaking on legal matters in any manner other than her opinions of the court, she would have no alternative forum. And then it seems to me the constitutional argument would be one thing. But here a judge does have considerable rights to speak. Our own code of conduct allows a judge to speak at seminars, to write papers on the law, educational talks. And the federal courts have told us that judges have considerable power to speak about the conduct of their court or other courts in the course of campaigns or just generally, and to the extent that our rules try to stifle that freedom, our rules have to be looked at very closely. So I just wonder about the constitutional. I would like your comments on the constitutional argument. Why does a judge have to have this particular forum to speak in? Why, if you allow somebody to picket down Main Street, do they also get the right to picket down Fannin Street or something?
If I understand the court's question correctly, it would be, how do you...
Why can't the court make this kind of limitation, given that Justice O'Connor has the opportunity to make these points in alternative and perhaps equally effective forums?
When you say equally available forum, are you referring to this civil review process?
No, I'm talking about law reviews, newspapers, stump speeches, continuing legal education.
Well,
programs.
I think, and I'm not a constitutional lawyer by the longest shot, but it seems to me that upon my reflection of the cases I've read in connection with this matter, that you aren't allowed, and I'm referring in this case to the respondent or the respondent court as it were, you can't say where you will do it, or if you get it somewhere, then you lose it here. That is to say, I don't think the respondent court can say, well, you can just go write a law review article, because then she's restricted in, as Justice O'Connor pointed out, her very power, the very part and largest part of her function, it seems to me, as all of our functions, His Honor's functions, and other members of other courts of appeals function, in part has to be to dissent from anything that they have a good faith disagreement with. If I may say so, when I first realized that there was a problem on this matter, I was struck. I was amazed that the respondent court was able even to consider the possibility of telling her she couldn't file it. I would hope that anybody who reads about this is shocked in the same degree. I went back to the office and I said, well, in any event,
counsel, when your time has expired, must leave, of course, granted.
I have a question, if I may. Judge
Gibbons. Mr. Gibbons, Chief Justice just asked you a question about why she should, why shouldn't the Court of Appeals, I think, be empowered to limit her forums. The the forum where the action occurred to prevent her from speaking in that forum, since other forums are available, law reviews, she could go on, she could have a press conference, presumably, or go on a political campaign of one sort or another, or against court. I don't know. The answer to this for me, if you will, seems consistent to me, or it seems reasonable to me, that that the pronouncement by any justice of the court should be in the forum where the action occurred primarily. If they want to take advantage of secondary forums as well, that's their prerogative. But should a court have the inherent power to limit a justice's inherent power by virtue of holding that office separately and individually from the other justices to address the issue in the forum where it occurs and where that justice sits?
I would agree that if you say, or if they're at liberty to say where she must publish her opinions, then they're restricting her very power.
Where did the action occur?
Where did the action occur?
Where did the actions she's aggrieved of occur?
Of course, within the Court of Appeals.
In the First Court of Appeals in Houston.
And so she should be able to respond in that forum in the usual way, i.e. by writing an opinion, as it were, in this case, a dissenting opinion.
It's totally inconsistent to me to rule otherwise. And as far as the power is concerned, each of us has an inherent power that's vested in us by the public. It's public trust, whether we get it by appointment, by election, or whatever device. Public trust and a responsibility to speak on the issues before us. To limit that to forums other than the forum in which we sit seems totally irrational.
I would agree, and in this case, what we've got is where it may deny a jurisdictional basis to our particular client. One of the jurisdictional bases being if there's a dissenting opinion in a court of appeals, then that gives us a right to take the case to this court by writ of error. That's been denied in this case by the
respondent. Has this court ever ruled on whether a dissent to a motion for en banc is sufficient to provide us jurisdiction under subsection 2?
I've searched and searched for a case distinguishing the two. I can't find it. And I made the argument in our brief that it would seem to mean you couldn't make a distinction insofar as it certainly, in this case, it was obvious that Justice O'Connor's opinion indicated and entailed a dissent from the majority's merits. That fact alone, it would seem to me, the very fact that it subsumed a merit dissent indicated, again, the jurisdictional basis for us to come here. May I answer any other questions?
Thank
you for the time.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Alice Oliver Parrott will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Alice Oliver Parrott. I'm Chief Justice of the First Court of Appeals, and I'm appearing on behalf of the First Court of Appeals. And if I might, Justice Gonzalez, to clear up perhaps what I think might be a misunderstanding, I would like to direct my remarks to you initially. You are absolutely correct that this justice voted in the first vote, actually voted that the court should sit en banc in this particular matter. My reasons for that vote are, of course, confidential and are on my own mental processes. Then, you're quite correct, sir, voted that I did not oppose Justice O'Connor's filing what she called an opinion and a dissent from a motion en banc. My mental processes for that also, I believe, by the canons, are confidential. However, sir, it is a misstatement to say that I am on anyone's side except the First Court side in this mandamus. This Chief Justice would not have called for a vote had I felt there was a clear and defined duty in the rules. If there were a clear and defined duty in the rules, my job would have been to, whatever they voted on, do what I believe the rules directed me to do. I do not believe there is a clear and defined duty in Rule 79 and 90, and I will address another constitutional issue if I might in a moment. And I certainly do not believe that the First Court's conformance with Rule 79 and Rule 90 amounts to an abuse of discretion by that court. I do not believe that a remedy of mandamus is proper and that it should be granted.
But in that regard, isn't it correct that the order that the first court entered on September 12th actually encouraged Justice O'Connor to come here to this court and encouraged this court, by the very terms of the order, to provide guidance to the first court in connection with this case as well as future cases?
Absolutely, sir. And if I might, Your Honor, because I am in a sort of an awkward position, because the canons prohibit me from saying so much, and yet I have so much I'd like to say about this point, I think perhaps since this is an issue, I think the canons would permit me to respond. There was a disagreement on the court, obviously, a 5-4 disagreement about what the rules allow. Because I felt the rules were unclear, and I still believe the rules are unclear, and felt they did, I could not tell they directly prohibited such a filing, nor did I believe they directly granted the right for such a filing. I called for a vote, and I said that as a member of the court, I would go with the majority of that court. After that vote, the court, Justice O'Connor, felt that the vote, objected to the vote. That she's the only justice to make that objection. And because she felt so strongly, and because we felt perhaps this is an event that might reoccur, and also because there's nothing called an advisory opinion in this great state, we discussed what her only remedy might be. And we wanted it never to be perceived that this is some personality conflict or some us against them mentality on the court. It is not. And in fact, the court has cooperated by using all its staff to help in the briefs on both sides and help in all the time and expense. Although we have a legal disagreement, and I can assure you we do, it is not one person against another person. And it just seemed that mandamus was the only potential remedy. Now, if I might respond to some points that have been brought up this morning, and I'm unaccustomed to time limits, so I'm going to keep looking at my slide. I think that the only two rules we can actually look at are 79 and 90. And rules 79 and 90 in no way, in my mind, clearly directs that an off-panel justice has a right of dissent. I will address later the First Amendment and the 14th Amendment and then the Texas Constitution, because I think there's a different argument. But insofar as the rules themselves, those rules, I just think any reading of them says that if a panel renders a decision, it is the decision of the court, and it is the panel that votes and speaks, the panel for the court. There is a provision for en banc, and I can assure you, and you can tell, that was very carefully followed in this regard. This is a pre-issuance. This is not a rehearing. We don't get all the way to 100. We're still up in 79 and 90. What we did in our court, and I'm proud of the first court that would do this, I think we're the only court that does it, we issue all our opinions full court, send them around, and we ask for exercise your First Amendment and tell us what you think of this opinion. And sometimes we are brutal with one another and candid. And this was an opinion that caused discussion. Any further comment about that, I believe, would be a violation of the canon.
Chief Justice,
yes, sir.
If there were three judges only on a court, if it were a three-judge intermediate court, and they decided a case one way on one day, and sometime later the precise issue was presented, and they decided it the opposite way, without attempting to distinguish or overrule the prior case, wouldn't that generate a considerable amount of confusion in the jurisprudence?
Absolutely, sir, but this is not, with all respect to Justice O'Connor, this is not about consistency of opinion. I disagree with her on that, like, totally.
Would you agree that courts with more than three judges should attempt to be consistent, either following prior precedent of another panel or in bank overruling?
If you're asking for my personal judicial philosophy, absolutely, sir. Let me just address a comment, just because what you've just said I think is very important. And this goes right to the constitutional arguments under the First Amendment, and primarily under the 14th Amendment, which is equal protection and due process. It is one thing to say that members of this fine court can dissent. There's but one of you. You set your own policy, you make the rules, we are guided by your actions. The intermediate courts of appeals in this state are a very different beast. Some of us sit, 9 of us, gathered together, some 13 in Dallas, some 3 in Waco or Eastland. I am now made aware by briefs filed that this right to dissent, a right to say what you think about an opinion and call it an opinion and file it, could possibly be used as jurisdictional grounds to get to this court. Would we not be denying equal protection under the 14th Amendment if we allowed a litigant in Houston, Texas, to have a better chance to get to the Supreme Court than a litigant that appeals his case in Eastland? Because the litigant in Eastland, of course, only has 3 votes that he can hope to generate disagreement and oral and in opinion form. And the litigant in Houston has 9 on our court, 9 on the 14th, and a litigant in Dallas, a real fertile ground of 13, that hopefully, you know, they could generate a bunch of disagreement, because there's disagreement on all court. That's why we're here, and that's why we call them opinions. Would we not be defeating the very constitutional protections we hold so dear if we allowed the intermediate courts to operate in such an inconsistent manner? Because a litigant could not expect the same hearing in a 3-judge court or in a court that sit in panels. I respectfully disagree with Justice O'Connor when she analogizes this to the United States Supreme Court or the Circuit Court or the Court of Criminal Appeals or this court. The Federal Circuit Court, if you're in the Second Circuit, the 11th Circuit, or the 5th Circuit, you have the same opportunity to generate a complaint.
Let me move you back to the argument that Justice Heck broached about consistency. We had an amicus brief filed here that does make a plea for your court to be consistent in your panel opinions, because lawyers in advising their clients need to know what the law is in your court. So you say you disagree with Justice O'Connor. This case is not about consistency.
I do.
But there's an amicus brief there that takes issue with you. Would you comment on that?
Well, actually, if you're speaking of the amicus brief filed by Mr. Townsend.
Yes, I am.
All right, it's like a 3-page thing to talk about. We ought to sit more on bonk, basically, what that says.
You've never sat on bonk, have I?
I've been on the court since 91, sir, and I am told that in the last 8 or 9 years they never sat on bonk. I can only speak to, since I've been the Chief Justice of that court.
I take his argument to be that your court ought to do what other courts of appeals, I think, do, and that is try to ensure that their opinions, at least for the court, are consistent panel by panel.
Yeah,
and that the panels don't each issue opinions on the same legal point and answer them in a contrary manner.
I couldn't agree with you more. Obviously, until May of 91, I haven't been on the First Court of Appeals, and I haven't been able to say too much of anything other than just what the hired help says in the district court, which is not much. I couldn't agree with you more. I agree 100% with that amicus brief. I don't think it pertains to this issue. I don't think the right to publish a dissent from en banc has anything to do with consistency.
Well, of course, if Judge O'Connor were outvoted in that vote to sit en banc, then it wouldn't promote consistency, because the court would not, in fact, sit en banc if she got all the relief she wanted in this case, wouldn't it?
Absolutely, sir. In my mind, the right to say you think something is inconsistent, it doesn't make it consistent. The court, in an orderly fashion, that's what en banc is, and the rule now tells us in en banc that if justices think something is inconsistent, they should vote en banc, and I agree 100% on that. But what I'm trying to, and with respect, you know, I don't mean to gloss over this, because I happen to agree with you. So it's like I can't dispute. I agree we should be consistent. Each panel should be consistent. I disagree that the first court has any policy to be inconsistent.
Do you agree
that? I think that is a misstatement.
But do you stipulate or agree that your court has issued inconsistent opinions on the same legal issues?
There is a case, 2 cases that are referred to in Justice O'Connor's petition, which are 2 criminal matters involving defendants in theoretically appealing on the same point that got 2 different results from 2 panels. I agree that those were inconsistent. I agree those 2 cases were inconsistent. I could not disagree more that my colleagues on the first court are dedicated to inconsistency or aim to write inconsistent opinions. I think the whole purpose of full court review and civil review is that we sit and talk and argue and fight, saying, you need to do this or you need to do that. I can't say that, I agree that, and I'm listening to the case.
Is she arguing that there's a design to be inconsistent or that the panels are acting without regard to consistency that we should have a right to expect from one court, even though it has nine people, who I presume rotate among panels? You're not Chief Justice of a panel. You're Chief Justice of the entire court.
Yes, sir. I just didn't hear the first of your question. You said, I think Justice O'Connor said that. I am disagreeing with that.
I don't understand her to be arguing that the first court is dedicated to inconsistency or by some design is promoting inconsistency between the panels, but more that the court is acting without regard for the consistency that we should have a right to expect from a single court. Internally, some of the courts of appeals, and I don't know what your internal procedures are there, but some of the courts of appeals have a system for the entire court reviews every opinion that goes out from the entire court conferences. They conference together and they review superficially every opinion that goes out, though it is the opinion of the panel representing the court that's signed by one of the judges of the panel.
Are you asking me a question, sir, because I just didn't understand the question?
You were arguing, apparently representing Justice O'Connor, is arguing that there's an advocacy for inconsistency there, and I don't understand her to be arguing that. I may be mistaken.
I understand her
to be arguing that they're acting without regard to consistency, without due regard.
I may have misunderstood. There were certain statements in the petition for leave to file mandamus that I may have misunderstood. At any rate, if it is only what you say, I would disagree heartily with that. I think there's great regard for consistency. Yes, sir?
I'll pose a question in another area. Public policy reason is there for the first court of appeals or any court of appeals to restrain the right of a judge to speak out in what I thought was a well-accepted point of view that judges speak through their opinions? Policy is there to, on the other side, in favor of restraining or restricting that speech?
If we're talking about policy, not the mandamus, whether it's a plan to find duty or that, if we're just talking about the policy behind this concept, I would say there's no public policy behind the judge not speaking out. We should have the freedom to speak out. The issue is, should it be put in opinion form, filed as a dissent with the court, and issued as a dissent to an opinion? And you're asking me what would be the policy against that. The policy, frankly, and I can't adopt each and every word of the brief because there's a lot about workload. I don't care anything about workload. I don't care if it made us work 500 times harder. I don't think that makes any difference at all, frankly, in all due respect to my colleagues who wrote that brief. So if we have to work, we have to work. I think the legitimate policy argument against it would be if that dissent was to be construed as, quote, disagreement on the Court of Appeals, so much as to become a jurisdictional ground for appeal to the Supreme Court, that if it is not done in every intermediate court in the state, it is the denial of equal protection under the 14th Amendment and under the Texas Constitution to the litigants in other parts of the state that are not don't have available to them multi-panel cases.
Other than how we might choose to treat it for jurisdictional purposes, then, And given your comments, which I certainly agree with, about workload, there really is not, and if we're trying to do any balancing to justify a restraint on a judge's constitutional right to speak through that judge's opinion, there's really not any public policy argument that you have to suggest why that speech should be restrained.
If I understand, and I don't want to misunderstand what you said, because I misunderstood what Justice Gamage said earlier, and I apologize.
Well, I probably garbled it.
If what you're saying is that it would merely be a statement, you can call it opinion, you can call it dissent, if it is just a statement that has no jurisdictional worth. It is just, I hate to use the word surplusage because I don't mean to diminish anybody's feelings about cases, but basically surplusage as far as the rules are concerned. I think that's something that we'd have to come from the Supreme Court telling us that, and in my mind, if that's all it was, you could file them and stay up nights writing 500 dissents.
Well, let me restate it again one more time,
because
I think it is important. If a judge has a right to speak through their opinions, and we're called on in analyzing the constitutional considerations of speaking through one's opinions, and perhaps to do some balance to see if there is any strong public policy interest on the part of the Court of Appeals to restrict the judge from that fundamental right expressed in the Texas Constitution, expressed in the United States Constitution, is I hear you telling us what we ought to balance against that right of the judge, it is only, the only public policy at stake is how it might affect our jurisdictional reliance on that decision.
I think that's the most important one. The 14th Amendment, equal protection and due process. I think, or open court. You know, does everybody get the same fair shake and wherever they go,
Judge,
get an appeal?
Chief Justice, do you believe that there, do you concede that?
Could I get
Judge,
her to answer the
I'm sorry, but I just had to finish. I apologize to you, Judge.
No, go ahead.
I just hadn't answered. But you made it sound like that's all.
I would say
the other public policy of utmost importance, that as intermediate courts, we take our direction from the Supreme Court. There is no policy for this. There is no precedent. In these briefs, there's a quote from the 11th Circuit talking about, they said this case, and the case is now left me, it's the 11th Circuit case of a big old dissent. And the footnote of that dissent, Justice Hill wrote the dissent, and what he said was, had this not become institutionalized, all these dissents, I wouldn't start this denial of motion for en banc. I believe the directive must come from the Supreme Court. It is not something that an intermediate court, in an inconsistent way, spot by spot, town by town, can come up with some policy on the rules. Either it's written directly in the rules, which I don't believe it is, with all respect. I don't believe it's clearly defined. Or the policy must come from this court that sets our policy and our standards. And what this court, if this court says to everybody, then personally, and as representative of the court, I would have no problem with it. But to do it in San Antonio or Corpus Christi, and not Houston, or to do it in Dallas and not El Paso, I think it's contrary to the whole philosophy of the intermediate appellate courts in our state.
There should be some consistency from our forum as well. Let me ask you one more question about your equal protection argument, though. Under our rules, jurisdiction for jurisdictional consideration, it is a consideration that there is a conflict on a panel or a conflict on a court, 3-judge court, 9-judge court, 13-judge court. That is one element of jurisdiction, but another element of jurisdiction that we consider is conflicts between the courts themselves, the first court, the third court, the 14th court, or 13th court, or whatever. So if someone in Eastland, if a court in Eastland hands down a unanimous decision that disagrees or conflicts with a unanimous decision out of Tyler, that's one way to acquire jurisdiction before this court. Why should it be any different, really, in a 9-judge court or 13-judge court, where one panel disagrees with another, or where one judge on that court, on any panel,
my time is
disagrees?
May I answer that?
You may.
Justice O'Connor made no attempt to dissent, though she may have argued vociferously. She made no attempt to file a dissent from the decision of the other panel. She was not on that panel. But when it came to the en banc motion, which was under consideration by the entire court, she disagreed and wanted to file her dissent from the decision of the court not to grant en banc argument to promote the consistency that she was arguing for. And yet the court said, well, you can vote that way, but you can't file, you can't argue that way in a published dissent. We won't allow you to do that. We won't allow you to air our dirty laundry or argue with our internal procedures in print. In a published dissent. She obviously has done it in print because she's been published in newspapers and magazines, on television, but the court has denied her the very forum on what she's, in which she sits to publish officially her dissenting opinion from the action of that court. And I presume you would agree that that is a decision of the court from which dissent would probably be appropriate. You voted for it.
May I ask, I think you've asked me three questions.
I've asked a bunch. Try to put it in context, Counsel. Your Honor, or however I'm supposed to address you under these circumstances.
I think, whatever, but may I answer these? Because I think first you've asked me about the 14th Amendment, then you've asked me about publication, which is a totally different thing under Rule 90, but I would like to address that. And then you sort of said, and I think you agree because you voted that way, and I would like to answer that, if I might. The reason I think the 14th Amendment on equal protection, also in the Texas Constitution, and the section I'm now losing, Article 1, Section 7, I think, the reason I think that's a legitimate argument, you're absolutely correct. In, you know, if there are two decisions, one out of Amarillo and one out of Eastland that are in conflict, that's grounds to get up here, one of the grounds. But it is an additional ground that would not be available in this other court. I don't dispute that there are ways you can get here from Eastland. They get here all the time from Eastland and everywhere else. But I merely point out that it seems to me to be a potential violation, something that should be a concern to the court. And I don't presume to tell the court constitutional law. I just bring it up for your consideration. It would be a potential problem in the area of equal protection to have an easier way to get to the Supreme Court from a multi-panel court than a three-judge court, and if that would be considered. It is additional ground. If I might continue. You may say what you...
I think what I hear you doing is arguing for an arbitrary limitation that, because it exists in one context, which is arbitrarily determined by the legislature, it can't exist in another context, which is arbitrarily determined by the legislature, and that is the size of a particular court. Because they wouldn't have this opportunity in a three-judge panel in Eastland to get our attention. They shouldn't have it in Houston either. That's basically what you're arguing.
No, no, sir, with respect. What I'm arguing is ever since Douglas versus California, which I think is like 63, the United States Supreme Court said there's nothing in the Constitution that guarantees you the right to appellate review. But if you have it, if you have appellate review, that it must be equal for all citizens, equal. And what they were talking about then, and I think it's in that Rourke case that they, latest one they talked about in 80, Rourke versus Shaw, talking about records for indigent defendants. But what it is saying is, in that case, that you couldn't even delay an indigent defendant more than a regular defendant that could buy a record, because it had to be absolutely equally available to every litigant. Because of that strong language of Douglas versus California Supreme Court case, and because of language, again, strong in the Fifth Circuit in this work, I'm mispronouncing it, versus Shaw, 1980, I believe it is of concern. I don't want this for the litigants of this state, but if this vehicle is available to one litigant in the state of Texas, it's not what I feel personally, it's what I believe the dictates of Douglas versus California and Root versus Shaw say it must be available to each and every litigant. This may be something of a no problem at all if it is not something that's used for jurisdictional ground. And as Justice Doggett sort of made me feel, I may have been jumping ahead of myself and worrying about something that's not an issue, may not be an issue. I just thought, since this court is going to be set in policy, that this is a legitimate concern when reading the dictates of these federal cases. And I had two other questions, and I knew them initially. And
that's all right.
Gotten them now.
We're in a situation where we may be either dazzling with brilliance or baffling with smoke and mirrors.
Must be that, but I forgot the last two questions, and I apologize to you.
I'd like to ask you a question about the consistency. Yes, you don't need to worry about the light as long as there are questions coming.
Yes, sir.
Of course, I suppose one way that the Court of Appeals could avoid inconsistency would be to sit en banc in every case.
Yes, sir.
But I also assume that the reason you sit in panels is to expedite the caseload of the court. that correct?
We're mandated to do so, but we do it in our court. For instance, we're filing 125 cases a month.
And you designate the panels to sit on?
Absolutely, sir. In our court, each court does it a little differently. In our court, we rotate every 3 months, so you mix the people up. Every four times a year, I sit on a different panel, and so do Justice O'Connor and all our brothers and sisters.
Well, I guess I'm not suggesting that one dissent in this case might have this impact, but could there come a point if a sitting member of the Court of Appeals decided to file dissents from denials of motions for en banc hearing in every case, or decided, even though they didn't sit on a panel, they wanted to file an opinion relating to the merits of the decision in that case or some aspect of the case, that it could affect the ability of that judge to get their work done?
Judge, you know, I know we argued that to some degree in our response. I was not so presumptuous to say what other people can do or not, even maybe other people are more efficient than I am, and maybe dissent to everything. I will say it's obviously just the practicalities. I mean, it creates a lot more work, and we, I believe, work very hard. We're sitting on 6 to 8 cases a week each panel. But I will say to you, with all respect, I'm not going to be so presumptuous as to say that about any judge on our court, because they all have a real sense of obligation, and I'm not concerned. It's a legitimate concern just for us to talk about, but I would not be so presumptuous to say some judge would let their work go down. You know, they're all elected by the people, and if they did that, I guess the people could unelect.
Justice Doggett was asking about countervailing interests, and the reason I raise the question is because could there come a point in which the due course of administration of the court's business suffers as a result, and is that a legitimate consideration?
You know where I think it would. I think that's a legitimate concern, but because I think it's so speculative, that's why I haven't really argued it, because I'm not sure how it would impact it. You see, I don't know how it would really flow down. One thing that's not quite so speculative, which just if we're worrying about what if, that's public policy. If we have a unanimous panel decision of 3 judges, and if we have 4 dissents to a motion for en banc, theoretically, I guess that could have happened here. The confusion to the litigants and to what is or is not the law might be another legitimate policy
if you have four dissents. Isn't that the very kind of thing that ought to get more attention by the Court of Appeals before it comes up here to the Supreme Court?
Well, of course, but I would say
shouldn't
that
it be heard in banc? I mean, isn't that a good education?
Obviously, I voted to hear the case.
I'm not talking about this case.
But exactly, and it's not about this case in particular. Absolutely. I think if we're talking judicial philosophies, I'm talking on my sort of person. But what we're talking about here is what the rules provide and how things go. And in all honesty, I think we followed the rules. And I think we have given this case and every case exhaustive attention. And the litigants in this case can be quite assured that they've been given about as much attention as humanly possible by any 9 people in any case.
Any other questions?
Any other questions?
I'm giving up on my questions. Thank you, counsel.
That concludes
the argument in these causes. It concludes the official. No, it doesn't either. There's Justice O'Connor. How much time remains?
May I please support Chief Justice? I would like to address the First Amendment issue first. This is the first time that argument has been raised. That was not the reason my dissent was refused, because that argument was never made. It's not made in the briefs. It's the first time I've heard it. But let's analogize the 14th Amendment argument to the courts of appeals with the federal system. The argument, if that argument had merit, over in the federal system, when a court had a circuit court of appeals had 6 judges and another one had 15, someone could argue, because I'm in a court that only has 6 and I only have 6 opportunities, or say 4 opportunities for dissent, and over here and with a court with 15 members, I have a potential 12 dissent That argument just doesn't work. But that argument does betray the underlying difference between what I believe a court is and what the majority believes a court is. I believe a court is all of its members, however large. If there are 3 members, that's the full court. If there are 15 members, that's the full court. And because it is a full court, any member may dissent from anything that judge can vote on.
Justice O'Connor, what if your internal rules of the court were that the panel of 3 does not circulate their opinions to the rest of the court? What then?
Well, what then is that the court is
would
trying...
Would the panel of 3 speak for the whole court?
Well, the court, all the panel of 3 always speaks for the full court. But
does,
what
that,
it is...
Doesn't that speak against the argument you just made? That only the whole court should speak?
Well, but because of convenience, because of workload, we break up in panels of 3. Now, underlying this whole argument, recall, 12 years have passed since this court had the authority to sit en banc. Not once has the court sat en banc. Why? Because there's no commitment in our court. There's no really compelling reason to sit en banc, because the only reason you'd go to the trouble, in our court we only have space for 3, you'd have to have chairs for 6 more. The only reason you'd go to that trouble is if you were really committed to the idea of consistency. I disagree with what the Chief Justice says about the underlying case in here. If you read my dissent, I say, I don't think we ought to be doing this because the Supreme Court of Texas has done differently. We have done differently. And then I cite 8 or 10 other courts of appeals that have done differently on that issue. Consistency is the problem in the underlying case, and the dissent is the only way to get it. But I ask you not to go for the idea that somehow it's a betrayal of constitutional principles for a judge on the first court of appeals to write a dissent from en banc. Recall that it's already been done in Texas. A judge on the San Antonio Court of Appeals joined a dissent from an en banc when that judge was not a member of the panel. It's already happened in Texas.
Is one of the reasons for your bringing this action to force the court to address consistency?
Yes, because it's such a difficult issue to get come forward. It happens with some regularity. We do meet and we do discuss cases, but unless a vote for en banc can pass, there is no other way. The court has so far been unwilling to muster 5 votes to bring a panel opinion into full court. But certainly, if a court is not consistent, I suggest it is not a court. Because the court has no function except to take the laws as it can as best perceive them and apply them consistently. If a court is a panel of 3 and is looking at a law and applying it in this case in this manner, and then another panel applies it in this case in another manner, there is that court is not acting like a court. It's perhaps acting like an ADR board or something. It's resolving perhaps this immediate dispute according to what's in the heart of those particular justices.
Accepting your argument that consistency is good, and I think we would all agree that consistency is a good thing, how would, since you were in the minority in the vote to hear the case en banc, how would filing your opinion promote consistency since you were on the losing side anyway?
In the Law Review article cited in my petition for mandamus, there is, I can't think of the name of it, they did a study of dissents from en banc in the federal system when the en banc motion fails. A much higher percentage of those cases is granted certiorari and granted review by the Supreme Court.
So you think there's a better chance we would grant writ?
I think there's... I'm using that to say it serves a function. It serves you. If you're interested in your own time, you will be interested in hearing opposite points of view from the courts of appeal. It's going to save you time.
Justice O'Connor, if we grant this mandamus, or if the rules were to change to Rule 79 and 90 clearly permit this, could we assume that any time you did not
write a dissent or note a dissent from a failure to hear, to grant an en banc motion that we, that you agree with the opinion of the three-judge panel?
I think you have to make that assumption that when a court, when an opinion comes out without a dissent, that the judges agree on the, that the full court agrees
well,
on that opinion.
But my question is, if in any case in the first court of appeals where there was a motion for an en banc rehearing, and you did not indicate your dissent, would the Supreme Court, the bench, the bar, and the public of the state of Texas be justified in assuming that you agreed with that three-judge panel?
I think I have to stand behind any opinion on which I do not dissent, and I think I have an obligation to dissent when I don't agree.
Mr. Townsend, in his amicus brief, has this statement. Without consistency of decisions, the courts are not doing justice under the law. Is that your position also?
Absolutely. Because there is no such thing as an inconsistent rule or an inconsistent law. There's only the inconsistent application of that rule, inconsistent application of the law. So therefore, when the court's coming up with inconsistent results, it's not the failure of the law or the rule. It's the failure of the court to apply the law consistently.
There's nothing in this mandamus proceeding, though, that obliges us or perhaps even authorizes us to look behind the issue presented and see whether or not we agree or disagree with your position as to this case.
Well, I submit that my dissent is written on the issue of consistency, as are most dissents from en banc. If you read the Fifth Circuit group of en banc dissents, most of them start off with, I wish we would have granted dissent, granted en banc, because this opinion is not consistent with our other opinions. So I think you can reach that issue. And if you look at the Textile Mills case to see what contortions the federal system had to go through before it could reach the issue of what is a court, is it the full court, I think the issue is much more squarely presented here than it was there, and I think you have the authority to ride on it. And one more issue that Chief Justice Oliver Parrott brought up.
Well, wait a minute. Somebody's got to ask a question.
Even if you were able to achieve internal consistency on the first court, you could not make our jurisprudence consistent being only one of 14 courts of appeals, could you?
No, and that's a good question because, you know, most...
So it is ultimately the Supreme Court's responsibility to make the law consistent, is not?
Yes, but in a court that has 9 members and they sit on 3 different panels, you're not looking at 3 different opinions of what one issue is. I ask a mathematician for help, and it's like 386 potential views on any one legal issue. I submit this court does not have the time to go through and muddle through potentially 386 interpretations of how an interrogatory must be answered. You need 14 courts of appeals coming up with consistent opinions so between those courts you can resolve issues. Most of the issues we resolve are not moral or ethical issues. Most of them are policy decisions, when something must be done, do you count from a certain date or another date. Those issues are best presented to this court when they come to a crisis between courts of appeals, not but when panels disagree among each other.
Any other questions? That does conclude the arguments for this morning. The foregoing clauses are submitted on briefs and oral arguments and stipulations of fact. The marshal will please adjourn.
The audience will please rise. Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now.